Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Hey, everyone, and welcome back to Alpha Chat, the business and economics podcast of the Financial Times. I'm Cardiff Garcia, and I'm back. Thank you so much to the amazing Shannon Bond for hosting and producing a really wonderful episode last week. And to our listeners, if you haven't listened to Shannon's interview with Gimlet Media co-founder Matt Lieber, I highly recommend that you go back and check it out. It was really fascinating. But for now, let's get on with today's show. First up on today's show, Ben Bernanke has a new book out, his memoirs, an account of his time as Fed chair. We're going to talk about it with the FT's U.S. economics editor, Sam Fleming. And then the proliferation of streaming services and how they're changing the television landscape. The stuff that you and I watch on TV, we're now all watching on our laptops, and we're going to talk about what it means for the television industry and for the companies that create this stuff, with Shannon Bond, the FT's media correspondent, and Matt Garahan, the FT's global media editor. And then finally, the Canadian elections, which have surprisingly global reverberations this year. We're going to talk about what lasting impact they're going to have on the U.S. and the rest of the world with the FT's Anna Nicolaou and Matt Klein. Stick around, lots of fun stuff today. And I'm here with U.S. economics editor Sam Fleming. Sam, welcome to New York.
Great to be here.
All right. We're going to start by talking about Ben Bernanke's memoirs, The Courage to Act. You reviewed it for the Financial Times last week. Your overall impressions?
I enjoyed it. It's very thorough, I think it's fair to say. It's a detailed account of Ben Bernanke's time at the helm of the Fed.
An attempt to prop up his legacy, to defend his legacy.
I think that's part of what he was trying to achieve. Yeah, I think that's very fair. I think he's obviously got criticism from both sides of the political divide for doing not enough, if you're from the left and if you're from the right, for allegedly pursuing policies which would debase the dollar and cause a crash and hyperinflation, which of course never happened. And he wants to set the record straight, also in terms of the Fed's interventions in the financial sector, trying to establish that this was to defend Main Street, as he says, not defend Wall Street, even if the perception was that the Fed was just bailing out bankers.
Sure. I mean, it seems like the critique from the right tends to come from politicians rather than from economists. So the idea that it was debasing the dollar, well, as a matter of fact, we've had quite low inflation in the time since the crisis. Amongst economists, there seem to be different kinds of critiques, right? So in the immediate acute phase of the crisis, in other words, during the panic phase of the crisis, I think most people give him plaudits for the action he took then to make sure that the financial system didn't collapse and that we didn't sink into a depression level, a depression-like recessionary period, right? In the time since, there's a little bit more debate about exactly what he could have done. So it's true that we got out of the acute crisis phase, but in the time since, we've had very slow, steady, but very slow jobs growth. The jobs recovery has been kind of weak. Slow wage growth, obviously on inflation. They've been missing the target in the time since. So it seems like amongst economists, the debate's quite different from the one that's taken place amongst politicians, right?
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I think that what he's trying to do in the book is explain, you know, the reasons that they took the various monetary policy decisions and why they were largely the right ones to take. I mean, you can argue that he should have pursued open-ended QE quantitative easing right from the beginning. They should have adopted forward guidance based on thresholds, again, right from the beginning, a low unemployment threshold. They should
forward guidance for just to, can you define that for our listeners who don't have a
effectively steering the market policy, that the rates would remain low as long as they needed to keep them low in order to stimulate a genuine recovery. And if you'd really thrown the book at this crisis on the economic side as well as the financial side, you might have got a more robust recovery. I think that part of what he's setting out really is that he did operate Under political constraints, as you said. He also operated under internal constraints. There was a broad church within the Federal Reserve, and not everyone was particularly happy with these extraordinary monetary policy solutions they were coming up with.
So in other words, other members, the voting members of the FOMC and the others on the Board of Governors disagreed with him sometimes about the appropriate monetary policy, and his job, as he saw it, was to wrangle a consensus, not always easily, though.
Yeah, this is I suppose something we're seeing at the moment with the Fed, which is that the Fed chair it leads the Fed obviously, but has to keep people on board. There were obvious examples of voting members of the FOMC who are deeply uncomfortable with any kind of stimulus, and you'd think of someone like Richard Fisher, formerly of the Dallas Fed, as an example of someone who really didn't think that they should be cutting as aggressively as they did, and that they thought that there was a risk of inflation, really, when in retrospect there wasn't.
Right.
There were, I think, possibly less publicly at the time concerns within the Board of Governors as well, and I think that's one of the very interesting elements of this book. Within the in the main corridor, within the in the Fed's headquarters, there were individuals who were. Especially in the era of 2013, the taper, when they started tapering their asset purchases, really concerned.
Slowing down the pace at which they were buying assets from the market, buying treasuries and I think some of the GSEs securities from the market. The tapering refers to that period in 2013 when they were debating whether or not to slow that down. There was a big market freakout at the time. So
Taper tantrum, exactly. Right. Yeah, and interestingly, within the walls of the Fed, there were three governors who he names as the three amigos, as he calls them: Jay Powell, Betsy Duke, and Jeremy Stein, now at Harvard, who all were saying that perhaps that tapering should happen a little sooner. They're worried that the Fed effectively was carrying on its stimulus a little bit too long. And so part of the case that Bernanke is building here is that, okay, he fouled up the exit from QE in some ways because of this taper tantrum that we saw in the markets. But there was a lot of politics inside the Fed, which people maybe weren't aware of at the time.
Yeah, and that's intriguing. I want to go back and kind of reframe all this in very simple terms. We have this period after the crisis phase has ended. The economy is still pretty weak. The Fed is trying to decide what the appropriate monetary policy is, dealing with the problem that interest rates are already at zero. They've lowered interest rates down to zero, but they want to find some other way of stimulating the economy. They effectively have two options, right? One is, as you just mentioned, quantitative easing, right, which is when they buy treasuries out in the marketplace or other government-backed securities like those of the GSEs. All right, you try to lower long-term yields, and there are all kinds of effects on that, maybe on confidence or other channels through which it operates. The second, which you also mentioned earlier, was forward guidance, which is effectively the use of language to guide expectations of what the Fed would do in the future. The idea being that if people in the markets are confident that the Fed is going to keep policy very loose, even as the economy recovers, that they'll be more confident about spending their money on hiring people and buying stuff, right? So you have these two ideas. We probably should mention that this is an unprecedented time in monetary policy history. It's all very complicated. The problem being that because it's unprecedented, people are worried about perverse and maybe unintended consequences. And so we get to this period in 2013 where you've got these other members of the Fed who are saying, hang on a minute, Ben Bernanke, okay? I'm not sure what this is actually going to do. We might be sowing the seeds for greater problems later on. And then he has, as you just took us through this process, he has to like try to find a way of wrangling a consensus. But we should mention that that is a Bernanke-specific thing, right? That Greenspan in the past, his predecessor, Alan Greenspan, wasn't as worried about that. And we're not exactly sure how worried about it Janet Yellen is, right? So talk about that. Talk about this idea that there are different ways of managing consensus on the Fed.
I agree. I think it's a fascinating issue to look at now and also compared with Greenspan. I mean, when Greenspan took over in the Fed in the 1980s, it took him a while really to establish a reputation, which he ultimately took on as being somewhat dictatorial within the Fed, really effectively taking the lead and almost being seen as a one-man band. That's overstating it slightly. But the famous book Maestro, I think, it encapsulates this idea that Greenspan was solely responsible for monetary policy in the US and therefore was allegedly the most powerful man in the world. Bernanke came in and clearly did not want to follow in Greenspan's footsteps. He saw it as unhealthy that so much was vested in one individual. And one obvious example of how he changed the tone was instead of as Greenspan used to, within the FOMC, the Federal Open Market Committee debates, Greenspan used to open the debate on what the policy should be with his view, obviously setting the tone for what the policy would be by the end of the meeting. Bernanke would allow others to speak first and then chime in towards the end, something that Janet Yellen has followed. So I think that's a more consensual approach. I think what also you get from the Bernanke book, however, is that as the crisis developed and things got worse, Bernanke really needed to actually step up and act. And so an awful lot of policymaking was driven by a small core of people within the Fed, particularly Bernanke, Don Cohn, the vice chair, and then Tim Geithner at the New York Fed. Fast forward to the situation now, which is what you're asking about with Janet Yellen. Again, you see that ideally, Janet Yellen would like to have a consensus on in the Fed policy making arena, would like to have as many people on board as possible. That is proving quite difficult because we're at a massive turning point in US monetary policy history right now. Do we keep low interest rates or do we start hiking them? It's quite a binary decision, and it's hard in that context to have a consensual approach.
You know, what's also intriguing about this too is that right now, the dissenting voices are coming from the other direction. So with Bernanke, there were people who were saying, wait a minute, policy's been loose for a very long time. Maybe we should tighten up a little bit, right, relative to where it was the time. Right now, the two recent dissenting voices, Daniel Tarullo and Lyle Brannard, right, both on the Board of Governors, are saying, well, hang on a minute. We don't quite know how healthy the U.S. economy is. Maybe we should wait before we start raising rates. How do you think Janet Yellen's incorporating all this information, given that the FOMC now seems to be quite split and dramatically so?
I think it is dramatically split. I think if you think of what you've got on the FOMC now, you've got, as you said, Lyle Brannard and also Daniel Tarullo arguing really that they don't want to see rates raised this year at all, very much emphasizing the risk that if you go too soon, there isn't much scope to reverse the error. So why take the risk? Effectively seems to be the gist of their argument at a time when inflation is really going nowhere. Stanley Fischer, who's the vice chair of the Fed, Federal Board, Reserve Board at the moment, is seen as more hawkish. He's in the past expressed discomfort with the idea of rates being at zero at a time when
he's ready to raise.
I think he's ready to raise. Janet Yellen has been signaling that she's getting closer to being ready to raise this year, so steering almost a middle way between them. But then on the other hand, you have a number of Federal Reserve presidents from the regional feds who've been arguing that they would like to see interest rates raised as well. And there was a symbolic vote in a recent meeting on the discount rate, which is, without going into details, it's a way for regional feds to signal whether they want to what they want to do with the main policy rate. And eight of those reserve banks argued in favor of an increase in that discount window rate, which is, suggests there's quite some hawkishness going on in the background there.
We should, because I get pilloried when I have conversations about these technical issues, if I don't connect it to how it would apply to people out in the real world, right? When we have these conversations and I don't say how they matter to people, to just normal folks, right? So let's talk about that. Raising rates, whether or not they go up, whether or not it's appropriate to raise them, how does this affect like Joe Blow, the average guy on the street?
Well, I think right now raising rates would, if the kind of increase they're talking about, a quarter point, would have a very, very modest impact on Joe Blow, frankly. It would probably not lead to a sudden spike in mortgage rates. I mean, I've spoken to people in the auto industry who don't think it would really have much impact on car loans. So we're talking about almost an experimental increase in interest rates. The reason it could have an impact, however, is that you really can't predict in advance how financial markets will respond to an increase in the policy rate and how individual interest rates in the markets will react. So, and this is something that the Fed worries about. Could the market, once this almost symbolic move is made, suddenly react and say, oh, this must be the beginning of a new era of tight monetary policy and that rates will continue to rise and therefore we should price that in advance? And that's one of the big worries the Fed has, and that certainly would affect ordinary people in America.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I guess the worry isn't what the immediate or direct impact would be of a rate hike, but rather what it would signal, what it would suggest about the Fed's preferences, about how the Fed intends to react in the future. And if everybody thinks, oh my God, they're going to slow down the economy already, then people stop buying, then companies stop investing, they stop hiring people, that would be the worry, especially if, as you said, financial markets have a total freak out.
Yeah, right? and there is history to this. Certainly in 1994, that's what happened when the Fed moved rates. The markets didn't feel properly ready, and you saw a big spike in implied borrowing costs in the bond market, which had an impact on the U.S. economy at the time. So, and actually, if you look at history, generally, when the Fed has started raising rates, it's carried on raising rates. It doesn't normally do a quarter point or a half point and then stay pat for months and months and months afterwards. So the markets would say, well, if they feel confident enough to do this quarter point, they must be confident enough to do more, and we better price that in.
Sure. And although it's not something I think I would worry about yet, I'm pretty sure you're not worried about it yet, we should also mention the other side of this, just in the sense, for the sense of fairness. Raising rates now or soon wouldn't be done just to prevent a later inflationary spike. There's also the view that it would be done to prevent the building of instability in the financial sector, right? This is something that a lot of people worried about. It's hard to define. It's hard to pin down. But we've seen in the past what happens if you let instability in the financial sector build up for too long. It means that when you do have a financial panic, it can be quite severe.
Yeah, I guess Exhibit A for this particular argument would be the 2000s, when we saw a big housing bubble brew up in the US. Many people argue that the Fed could have done more to prevent that if it had had higher interest rates at the time. Now, someone like Ben Bernanke would strongly resist that argument. He would say that it was regulation which needed to do a lot more to prevent the disaster in the 2000s. And that there were big global forces which kept interest rates low, which the Fed would have struggled to resist with higher interest rates. So it would be a blunt instrument to try and prevent that. But it's certainly something people worry about now. They're always looking for the next source of financial panic, financial boom, and then bust. And, you know, this is something that the Fed itself, it continually, I wouldn't say pays lip service to, I think they mean it. They say, we are aware that when you have very low interest rates for a long period of time, financial instability can brew up. But right now, we don't think that case is compelling enough to, on its own, warrant an increase in interest rates.
Bottom line, the courage to act. Thumbs up or thumbs down?
I'll give it a thumbs up.
Sam Fleming, U.S. Economics Editor. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks a lot.
And in the next segment, people are changing the way they watch video. They're not seeing it on TV anymore. What are they doing, and what does it mean for the companies that produce this stuff? I'm joined now by Matt Garahan, Global Media Editor, and Shannon Bond, Media Correspondent. Matt, you first. Scoop of the week. What exactly is Disney Life, and why does it matter?
So Disney is the world's biggest media company by market value.
I've heard of it.
You may be familiar with some of its titles, and they are launching in the UK in November a digital service, a subscription service that bundles together their classic animated movies, their live action movies, their books, and their albums, and all sorts of other things in one monthly price, which you'll be able to stream and watch on your TV if it's connected to the internet, or your phone, or your iPad or tablet or whatever.
Essentially all the Disney content you could want, not just television shows, not just movies, but books and other kinds of things as well.
Yeah, kind of all the bells and whistles, not though Star Wars movies or Marvel superhero movies, but everything else pretty much than that.
Okay, only available in the UK.
Yes, but they have plans to roll it out across Europe with the goal, I think, of launching in France, Germany, Italy, Spain in the next 12 months or so.
Why not do it in the US?
Good question, and one which we put to them. And the issue, I think, from what I can gather, is that there are many more cable companies, satellite TV companies, distributors of Disney content, Disney product in the United States. There are obviously distributors in Europe too, but there are fewer of them. And they had to navigate around these agreements to launch this thing. Because if you have, you know, easy availability online of Disney content, it might, you know, they'd run into problems with their other distributors.
Okay, now let's put this into the context of the broader theme that you and Shannon wrote about in a separate story also this week.
Yes.
Right? The idea that people are now starting to watch the stuff that they used to watch on television, their shows, their movies, they're watching it not on television. They're watching it online, on their tablets, on their computers, that kind of thing. Shannon, what happened this summer that sort of brought this into stark relief for everybody, that now a lot of these companies that produce this stuff are realizing that they're going to have to make some pretty big adjustments?
Well, we saw, as you mentioned, this summer, there was this kind of watershed moment for a lot of the big media companies, including Disney and a few others, who reported their quarterly earnings in August and were just really slammed by the market because they basically warned that they weren't going to see the kind of growth they had been accustomed to. Disney particularly warned on ESPN, which they own, the sports channel, and just saying, you know, people have more options. There's more places to watch all kinds of content, both ours and others. And it's going to be more difficult for us to kind of command the same audiences that we used to when everyone sat down in front of the TV at night to watch. So that caused a big market fall for a lot of the media companies and kind of a moment of reckoning for them to say, we actually, you know, streaming isn't some sort of side thing that we can kind of ignore. This is actually possibly like integral to the future of our business.
I mean, I would say that would even be a bit of an understatement, right? This wasn't just a big market fall. This was something akin to like a calamitous drop, like a day of reckoning.
It had its own name. They called it Media Meltdown.
Media Meltdown.
Yeah, $37 billion wiped off the market cap of top media stocks in a day, basically on the back of this warning from Disney that the growth had slowed at ESPN, the kind of powerhouse
right.
cable network.
So there's a lot of intricate issues here, but I guess the first thing that comes to mind is, why now? I mean, we've heard about cord cutters, about people who have ditched their TV sets just to watch online for a while. Was this sort of a belated recognition by the market of something that had already been happening?
It's been happening for sure. I mean, you've been sort of seeing a slow trickle. And don't forget, I mean, a company like Netflix has been around for a long time now, is getting a lot of people to subscribe. And they have something like 40 million subscribers in the U.S., who are, you know, watching TV and movies. What's changed in the past year has been, A, the big players, primarily Netflix, Amazon with their Prime Instant Video service, and to a lesser degree Hulu, are making original content. So they're not just buying content from the TV studios, they're making their own. So they're essentially now competing directly in that business. And a bunch of these media companies have started to see the writing on the wall and are testing the limits of those contracts that Matt mentioned with their distributors. So last fall, you saw HBO, the premium cable channel, and CBS, the broadcaster, both launch apps that allow people to watch whatever they want to watch, anywhere they want, whenever they want, on their phones. And it's really sort of that started to take off. There's a lot of other companies that are now testing the waters.
I think the other issue, going back to the summer, is that because it was Disney that warned, right? And Disney up to this point had been Teflon, right? Nothing could harm it. And ESPN in particular, because it's live sport. People tune in for live sport. They don't. That's the one thing they don't cut the cord. They don't cut. They stay with their live sport. And for Disney to say, oh, we're a bit worried here that, you know, our rate of growth at ESPN is slowing, that suggested something was pretty amiss. And that's what sent everything into a tailspin.
It's just kind of a rare instance of like a big global behemoth essentially being proactive, in other words, recognizing what was happening ahead of time and saying, we don't want to be caught off guard. We don't want to be reactive here. We need to start changing things now.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of this is they're looking at the straight economics. I mean, they've made a lot of money. The traditional TV networks have made a lot of money for a long time now from what are called retransmission fees. So the cable and satellite providers pay them money to distribute their channels to their customers. You know, and they get a pretty good slice per customer. But that's kind of been predicated on this model of a big bundle of channels. You know, you pay whatever, $100 a month, say in New York, you know, for hundreds of channels, most of which you probably don't watch. They're not all worth
the through a cable subscription.
You pay Comcast or Time Warner or whoever it is, Cablevision. And not all of those channels are being watched, but kind of the less popular channels are being subsidized by the more popular channels. And so the content owners have been doing really well. Now, you know, with increasing pressure from consumers saying, like, I don't want to pay for this. I'm not watching all of these things. Even the cable companies are now offering what are called skinny bundles, so smaller bundles of channels for cheaper prices. You know, and they're beginning to push back against some of these companies that have less popular channels, Viacom being an example, where they're saying, you know, we don't necessarily need to carry everything that you're offering because people aren't watching it. It's, you know, and so then that's really disrupting, to use an overused word, but it is disrupting like the model on which the companies have been pricing this content for a long time.
But it is an overused word, but it is a good word to use in this case, because going bringing it again back to Disney with this app that they're launching, Bob Iger, the Disney CEO, has sort of been out in front on a lot of these issues. Bob Iger, who's on the board of Apple, by the way, Apple, Tim Cook said this week, why do we need TV? You know, TV isn't working. TV is sort of, you know, the whole idea of sitting down to watch television is outdated, outmoded, when you can watch TV in any way that you want. Bob Iger shares those beliefs and said, told us, you know, he'd rather disrupt than be disrupted, which is why they're going direct, why they're going over the top with an app instead of relying on channels.
Now, I like this quote because it was actually more aggressive than the way you just portrayed it. Yeah. It was, why does a television channel even exist?
Yeah, that's the Apps
Cook are line. The future.
Yeah.
The Tim Cook line. Yeah.
Yeah. And he and Bob Iger are kind of in lockstep on this. You know, I mean, Apple and Disney have over the last decade or so, have been pretty in tune with the way media is changing and shifting. And I think more evidence of that here.
Sure. And it seems like this also represents a shift in how consumers, people who watch this stuff, emphasize their own preferences. Because actually, there were some economic benefits to the bundling approach, right? You know, for a consumer, you get all this extra variety.
There still are. I mean, frankly, if I'm going to pay for a Netflix subscription and a HBO subscription and an Amazon subscription, and maybe I want CBS or I want to try the new comedy service from NBC, and I'm paying for broadband, it's actually, I'm probably not paying
starting
less.
Starting to add up.
Yeah. But I think what's appealing to customers is this idea that they have the control. Mm. That if I'm going to be paid that much anyway, I want it to be, I want to watch on any device that I want. I want to watch on demand. I want to have access to every season of, you know, a show that I love, as opposed to sort of the more limited options they've gotten in cable.
Yeah, because they can tailor it. Yeah. They can make it their own.
Yeah.
So a la carte rather than the set menu, right?
I guess the way I'm thinking of it is that is psychologically appealing, even if, because it's harder to recognize those economic benefits of bundling, right? You can say, well, I get to choose exactly what I want, not realizing that actually there might be other stuff out there that you'd love to have. You just didn't know that you'd love it because you're not going to get exposed to it.
Right.
Do you guys still have your own cable subscriptions, by the way? Have you cut the cord yet?
I cut the cord probably earlier than most, back in 2009.
I thought about it this summer. Our contract came up and thought about it, and we did the numbers on the things that we wanted to watch. And decided to keep it. We got a bit of a better deal, but we decided to keep it.
By keeping it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because as Shannon said, you know, you add in all the things that you, you know, all the channels that you watch, all the apps that you need to buy.
Right.
And the price goes up.
And there's tension, right, between some of these companies and Netflix and these other providers now, because essentially they've given away the content that they now want to offer themselves.
Yeah. The big media companies are having another look at their relationships with Netflix. So 5 years ago, they were giving everything to Netflix, getting very paid handsomely for it. And as a result, Netflix has become this gigantic business. It's almost, you know, almost worth as much as 21st Century Fox, right? It's a $50, $60 billion company. And the companies that make the programming that Netflix has used are now saying, hang on a second, we've got to think about this. We can exploit this ourselves. We can sell it to the highest bidder elsewhere. We can put it in our own app, as Disney is doing here in Europe. You know, we can monetize it in a different way without feeding a company which is going to eat our lunch somewhere down the line.
Is there something almost sad about the fact that all of these different providers are effectively siloing themselves off from each other rather than all being in one place? Like, are we going to lose part of the television watching experience in that you used to be able to turn on your TV, channel surf for
it's
a little
gone.
While,
yeah.
serendipitously yeah. find something? I cut the cord earlier this year, and I don't regret it at all.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to me that now you have to know what you want before you when you go to look for it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think the behavior has changed. You don't have that kind of serendipity, and that's actually something that people like Netflix and Hulu, which in some ways in this new world of apps for every channel, are a little bit of a throwback to a bundle, right? Like Netflix has kids programming and horror movies and documentaries, you know, and, you know, a lot of popular TV shows. But it's all in a bundle, and they want to show you things that you might not think of yourself. So they're investing a lot of money like in their sort of technology behind recommending. Hulu's doing the same thing because they have to kind of – they're trying in a way to recreate that serendipity of channel surfing in a non-channel surfing environment.
Sure. Last question, because you guys compare this to the disruption that's gone on in other parts of the media landscape. Are these companies going to be able to make the economics work for them?
I think they will. I think
not all of them, though.
Well, the ones that...
The big ones.
Yeah. I mean, if there's an audience and it's willing to pay, you know, you're substituting the great deal that well, the media companies are substituting the bountiful money they were making in the bundle. I mean, it's $120 billion a year business, right? About $60 billion in ads, $60 billion in carriage fees. And one of the people we spoke to said, that's the golden goose, which is worth protecting, right? And they are, you know, possibly substituting digital pennies for dollars, but they can't afford not to go where the consumers are. And some of them will fail, but the ones with the most compelling channels and the most compelling content will stick around.
And maybe you just end up having fewer channels because you don't have this sort of, you know, the implicit subsidization of channels that maybe fewer people watch. On the other hand, a small program that's less popular, a channel that's less popular, if you're selling it direct to consumer, you can actually find an audience. So there's a counter argument there. So I don't know. I could argue it either way.
Shannon Bond, media correspondent, Matt Garahan, global media editor. Thanks for being on Alpha Chat.
Thank you.
Thanks, Cardiff.
And on the next segment, in Canada, say goodbye to Stephen Harper and the Conservative Party after a decade in power. Say hello to Justin Trudeau and the Liberals. I'm joined here by Matt C. Klein and Anna Nicolau, our Northern Territories correspondents, if you will. Anna, you lived in Canada for like a decade. Are you stunned by what happened?
I am stunned.
What did happen exactly? Because this was a blowout. The Liberals won in a blowout.
Yeah, I think it was a surprise to a lot of people. It was quite a long campaign historically for Canadians. It was 11 weeks. And even a month ago, it wasn't really projected for the Liberals to win the most seats in Parliament, let alone win enough to hold a majority government. So that was certainly a surprise. I mean, throughout the campaign, it had been kind of a tight three-way race up until the last 2 weeks or so. And in the final few days, there was really a surge towards the Liberals and Justin Trudeau.
What do you think accounted for the big surge in support for the Liberals towards the end? Because I think a lot of people were expecting that they would have to form some kind of a coalition with the third party, the New Democrats. And it turns out that actually the Liberals are in charge all by themselves now.
Yeah, I think there were a few different factors. I think the Liberal Party ran probably the best campaign of the three parties. Justin Trudeau, a lot of people had sort of written him off over the summer as, you know, not being...
Pretty boy.
Yeah.
Too young.
Being a pretty boy, too young, just not ready, as Stephen Harper said over and over and over. But he performed a lot better than had been expected in the debates. He was kind of more passionate than the other candidates. And there were other factors. As we talked about last time, the left side of Canada was split between two parties. And as the NDP dropped a bit in the polls, that worked in his favor. I think his economic policy also gave him a boost in the polls.
Yeah, talk about that for a minute. What's the difference in the economic policies of the three candidates?
That was the big part where he kind of stepped away from the pack. So you had Tom Mulcair, who is the leader of the NDP, which is the most left-wing party of the top three contenders. And then you had Stephen Harper, who was the Conservative leader, as we talked about. And so both of them were calling for balanced budgets and this kind of fiscal responsibility and austerity measures. And Justin Trudeau pulled out this economic plan calling for essentially fiscal stimulus, calling for running deficits of $25 billion in the next 3 years to invest in infrastructure and building roads and tunnels, just kind of drawing the line of, you know, we need to take out a loan basically to reinvigorate our economy.
Right, which is flagging.
Yeah, which has been slowing because of all the oil problems. So I think that was something that was a bit of a risky move, but it paid off for him because Canadians saw, you know, the economy's not doing well. Maybe we should just change something.
Yeah, and I love this idea that Trudeau's essentially said, well, hang on a minute, all right, there are some lessons that we can learn from what's happened in Europe and the U.S., and that he essentially broke ranks with the other two by saying, what's the point of a balanced budget right now? All right, interest rates are at zero. Okay, there's probably a lot of space in which, you know, Canada can borrow, the sovereign can borrow. So why not invest the money? And it's kind of interesting because we're going to get a very real experiment in what happens when you do that rather than worrying about a balanced budget. Let me turn to Matt. And by the way, are you not impressed that Matt, a Chicagoan born and raised, has this like quirky interest in the Canadian economy?
Yeah. Somebody has to.
I'm impressed, right? Like on Jobs Day every month, he just blows off the US numbers and goes straight to Canada. It's awesome. Matt, let's talk about the Canadian economy for a minute. It's in a technical recession right now. What's going on over there?
Right. So the past two quarters, GDP, real GDP has shrunk slightly. It's still bigger than it was a year ago. So whether, you know, it's not a severe recession yet, but we've definitely been seeing some cutbacks in spending, particularly in business investment spending associated with oil, which is a big deal in Canada because as of 2014, which is the latest year we have full data for it, about a third of all CapEx comes from the oil sector. So,
big net exporter of oil.
That's correct.
Canada.
That's correct. And a big, just a big producer of oil in general. It's relatively small in terms of employment, but a lot bigger than in the U.S., for example, or in most other rich countries. And so as oil prices have fallen a lot, even though the Canadian dollar has fallen somewhat to help offset it, the income available for producers and the attractiveness of a lot of production has gone down. So you've been seeing big cutbacks in spending there.
Let's explain this for a minute there.
Sure.
Okay, so the oil price falls. That means that the value of something that Canada produces and sells overseas also falls. That hurts the economy, okay? In the meantime, the loonie, the Canadian dollar is called, has depreciated quite a bit. You would think that that would help because it would make Canadian products cheaper. It would be able to export more.
Right.
Okay, but that, you're saying, has not been enough to offset the damage from lower oil prices.
Right. Basically, the Canadian dollar has not fallen nearly as much as the oil price. That's okay. The short version. I mean, it's not like the ruble or the Nigerian naira, right, or things like that. So the Canadian economy has been slowing there. We've also been seeing this. It hasn't yet shown up in, say, like job losses, but you have seen something roughly akin to that, which is that prior to the decline in oil, Alberta, which is the major oil producer within Canada, it's about 80% of all the oil in Canada comes from that province. And within that province, CapEx is overwhelming. It's like two-thirds of all business CapEx goes towards oil. They had been disproportionately adding jobs relative to the rest of Canada. They're roughly about 10, 11% of the population in Canada. Over the past few years, they had been adding about a third of all the jobs. So that's clearly punching above their weight. Since then, if you just look, say, the past 2 years, it's shrunk significantly closer to like 15%. So it's still better than their population share would suggest, but you've been seeing that. And if you also look at the growth rates in employment from Alberta versus the rest of Canada, you can see a real convergence towards a common rate where Alberta had been adding jobs much faster.
Yeah, and let's just clarify for a minute. Just because Canada is not actively losing jobs, the pace at which jobs grow, and that's what you'd expect jobs to grow by a certain amount, that has slowed down.
That's correct. And in fact, if we look at just the share of the population that has a job, which is, I think, a reasonably good measure of, you know, the state of the labor market, it's been flat basically since 2012. So there was a bit of a drop-off, understandably, during the crisis and recession. There was a recovery, and then it's basically been flat. So it's not actually as bad. It's not like in the U.S. where it's far below where it was. If you look at, say, like 2005, 2006, Canada's employment rate is basically the same now as it was then. But there hasn't really been any improvement since then, and wage growth has been relatively slow. So productivity growth has also been very slow, so that arguably fits in with that. So it's not you can see why, with the decline in oil and the decline in investment, people in Canada be worried that if things hadn't been getting better when things were doing well, that they could potentially get a lot worse.
Yeah, and there's one other thing to talk about here too. Okay, the housing market. Canada has one of the best documented housing bubbles, if it is a bubble, in the world. All right, and for years and years, people are predicting that the housing bubble is going to burst there. Why has it not?
Yeah, I mean, it's striking that the IMF has been pretty vocal in saying, yeah, we think the housing in Canada is overvalued. We're not sure how much, but, you know, probably 20% at least, which is kind of striking. They didn't say that kind of thing as much. They weren't as vocal about that before with other places. In terms of, you know, why it hasn't burst, it's tough to say. I mean, the Canadian financial system is quite a bit different than the U.S. one. They didn't have the kinds of subprime situation that we did with extremely high loan-to-value ratios, low documentation. They didn't securitize it to the same extent. A lot of this stuff is held by a handful of banks that have relatively stable profit margins because they're an oligopoly and they can get away with just extracting
it's
profits.
It's not this massively entrenched part of the financial system.
Right.
The way it was here.
Right. Housing is. It's just that it's administered by banks that have, at least at the moment, pretty good stable profit
streams.
Okay,
so it might not be as big a threat, but still would presumably cause a fairly big downturn if it were to
burst.
It
is striking because, I mean, construction, first of all, has been responsible for a ton of the job gains. In terms, it's the fastest growing employment sector they've been having for quite a while. Other sectors are big too, things like healthcare and so forth. But construction is very big. House price increases have been enormous. If you look before 2008, they pretty much tracked the U.S. on the way up during the bubble. U.S. house prices subsequently went down. Using U.S. housing debt went down with that as people defaulted. Canada was the opposite.
Kept going up.
Right,
is
just kept
it,
rocketing
is it possible
upwards.
That it's not a bubble?
I mean, bubble, you know, that is a very loaded word. You can conceivably argue that in a world where mortgage rates are, say, half what they were 10 years ago, give or take, that the discount rate at which you would evaluate the, you know, a piece of property ought to be a lot lower. And so you could argue that if rents are sort of growing along with GDP, then house prices ought to be a lot higher now than they were before.
Sure, but let me rephrase this. Is it possible that there are sound fundamental reasons for Canadian house prices to be as high as they are now? So for instance, we know that there's a lot of foreign buying or buying by immigrants right. in Canada, and there's been quite a big influx of those in the last decade or so. Is it possible that it's a simple case of demand outpacing supply for the time being?
There definitely is a lot of demand. As you mentioned, Canada has relatively high immigration compared to, say, for example, the U.S., and in particular, it's been a very attractive destination for wealthy Chinese who want to get their money out of the country, and also it's relatively easy to get Canadian residency if you spend enough on housing. So it's, at least for a few markets, places like Vancouver in particular, but also some of the other cities like Toronto, that could explain some of it. It's not really the situation the way it is in, say, Australia and New Zealand, where there is, or certain U.S. cities where there are constraints on building. There's been an enormous amount of construction of condos. Okay. But there's definitely real demand.
Okay. Turning back to the elections, Anna. This election was, I think, more closely watched by people abroad than previous Canadian elections. First of all, why do you think that is? And what do you think the impact is going to be on, for instance, the relationship with the U.S. or other parts of the world and Canada because of the outcome?
Just kind of looking at American media coverage of it, it seems a good amount of it is Justin Trudeau. People kind of saw this like charming, good-looking guy, and people have been making comparisons to Obama.
Obama of Canada.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of weird shirtless photos of him all over Gawker. I think his personality kind of drew people to it as a storyline. I think the fact that it was such a surprise, it was a surprise, but also it was a very big change. I mean, the Conservatives had ruled for a decade, and people weren't really expecting this kind of outcome. I mean, in terms of the effect on the international community, I think a lot of people blame Stephen Harper for kind of tarnishing Canada's image with the world, particularly on a lot of the environmental stuff. He pulled Canada out of the Kyoto Protocol. He didn't sign a bunch of treaties with other countries on the environment. So I think people...
It's an oil-related thing too, by the way.
I mean, he kind of had these ambitions of Canada's going to be this energy superpower. And that was his big priority throughout his time serving as prime minister. So I think that also with Justin Trudeau, I think people are hoping that, and he's made it a big point in his campaign that he's going to, you know, restore ties with the U.S. and make Canada look like a nice country again.
Sure. I think there's also at least another part of his platform that's sort of firmly progressive, right?
Yeah.
By the political definition of the word progressive. Mm-hmm. In other words, the Conservatives were not the type to, say, raise taxes on people who make a lot of money. Trudeau, I think, has been open to the possibility of cutting middle-class taxes, but raising taxes on people who make more than 200,000, I think was the number, Canadian dollars.
Yeah, all those things are part of his campaign, talking about cutting taxes for the middle class, raising taxes on Canadians who make more than $200,000 a year. So all of that kind of tied in with his image of trying to help, you know, Canadian guy.
So I guess maybe in some sense also more in tune with like the global zeitgeist and the newfound emphasis on inequality that's been such a big prominent part of the economic conversation in the last few years.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, inequality has definitely hit Canada as well as obviously in the U.S. with the economic recovery. So I think that was a part of it.
Okay. Well, you guys are my Northern Territories correspondents. Every time anything having to do with Canada comes up, you're coming back, okay? No choice in the matter. Anna Nicolau, Matt Klein, thanks for being on Alpha Chat.
Thanks, Cardiff.
Thanks.
And in the follow-up segment today, Amelia Mahasek and Shannon Bond has stayed here because, guys, I want Shannon to be able to face her critic, unlike what you guys did to me last week when you talked behind my back. Yep. By necessity.
You were here in spirit.
Yes, indeed.
And you're surrounded by three women today, Cardiff.
Yes, that's true.
That's so we could do a really good he said, she said, and she said, and she
and
said.
And nobody would believe me.
That's not true.
Emilia, what stood out about last week's episode, guest hosted by the mighty Shannon Bond?
The mighty Shannon Bond was fabulous. It was your segment that I've got an issue with.
Unsurprisingly.
The segment with Greg Ipp, which was cut short necessarily, and you may tell me that I'm wrong. If listeners were to luxuriate in the full hour, or what's the long form?
The long form on Alpha Chatterbox lasted about 50 minutes with Greg.
Okay, so which was about his book.
Yes.
Which essentially, as far as I can tell, advocates that recessions are a good thing.
No, that it's okay for some either instability in the financial system to play out. In other words, that it's okay for the stock market, for instance, to go down sometimes. It's okay for some other asset markets to go through periods of volatility because it makes sure that people aren't complacent. And something similar applies to very shallow recessions, right? In other words, it's not a good thing that like a ton of people lose their jobs, that kind of thing. But some volatility in the economy is acceptable so that you avoid a much larger, as we described it, conflagration down the road. That similar to forest fires, it's okay to let the occasional forest fire burn because it clears out some of the brush so that later you don't get one that's impossible to pull out. So he was making that analogy. But I think his point was that it's actually very hard to tell in the moment whether or not it's the kind of recession or it's the kind of financial market volatility that you should allow to take hold versus the one that you should try to put out immediately. His point was that even after a couple of years of researching it, in real time, it's very hard to know what the right framework is for thinking about that.
So my issue would be that conflagration is fine as long as it's not your house that's burning down. So the human element, which I think I've brought up before about economics discussions, seem to just be missing. And so perhaps it's there in the 50-minute alpha chat.
Yes, it is.
But in the excerpt, I felt like we were talking about the abstract of recessions and people losing their jobs. And in fact, I think Martin Wolf has said it's not a good thing to experiment with having a full-on recession or a depression or not, you know, talking about these things in abstract terms that don't relate to human lives.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. Good criticism. All right. So choose our excerpts, choose our clips better.
Well, so I will be interested to listen to the whole 50 minutes and see his redress to the human cost.
Sure. You should. It was a great chat. Highly recommend it.
And otherwise, Shannon was fantastic.
Yes, he was. Matt discussion with Matt Lieber, I thought, was a real highlight of last week's episode.
Absolutely. So, founder of Gimlet Media. I'd like to hear more founders, actually, if we can find them.
People if they're willing to talk about. I mean, I think one of the things that's been so interesting about Gimlet is because their first show was about themselves. They sort of, I mean, especially for a startup, they have a really high level of transparency, and you just don't get to see that. So, I mean, if we can get people who will actually sort of, you know, open the kimono a little bit,
right?
It's way more interesting.
Great guest. Shannon did an awesome job. I think both of you will be happy to know that this week, in response to last week's follow-up segment, all right, we're discussing rate rising, okay? We're discussing how that affects the little guy, okay?
And little woman.
In the context of Ben Bernanke's memoirs and his attempts to defend the legacy. Those of you who are listening have already heard that, but hopefully that will stave off future critiques from one Emilia Mahasek. We need to give you like a nickname.
She's an ombudsman.
Right? Yeah. It was like something that, because you do this after the fact, maybe you're like the Grim Reaper or something like that. I don't know. It's like, I don't know.
Passing judgment.
Yeah, that's too. The Grim Reaper doesn't. He just kills you or something. He just takes you to your death. Yeah, something else. We need something better. What's a good nickname for Emilia? We're going to work on it.
Okay.
Use that. Solomon.
Who knows? Solomon.
Has to be a woman.
I know.
Emilia Mahasek, Shannon Bond, always a pleasure, guys.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks.
And that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks for listening. As always, you can go to ft.com/alphachat to see show notes and other links relevant to today's episode, or you can give us a call at 917-551-5012 to give us feedback and ask questions, give us recommendations for future episodes. You can also send us an email at alphachat@ft.com or even record a voice memo on your phone and send that to us via email. Finally, you can tweet me directly at Cardiff Garcia. Amy Keene is not yet 35, and she's Canadian, which means she's not allowed to run for president in this country, but I would absolutely vote for her. In the meantime, I'm just thrilled that she produces and edits this podcast. Thanks again to our listeners, and we'll see you next week for another episode of Alpha Chat.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.